Okay, let's unpack this. Today we're doing a deep dive into an ancient event that still causes quite a stir, the Council of Chalcedon.
Right, a really pivotal moment.
Exactly. Now, you might be expecting us to get really deep into the theology, but our mission today is a bit different.
Yeah, we've got some pretty fascinating source material here. It gives us more of a what you might call a forensic analysis of the
That's
council.
forensic analysis. I like that. Focusing on things like, well, its procedural integrity, any potential biases, and crucially, the role of imperial influence.
It's kind of like being historical detectives, uncovering the hidden mechanics behind it all.
And what's really striking, I think, is that the council's own records, the acts, they basically admit, and this is almost a direct quote, that the circumstances of its meeting and the politics that shaped its course did not permit truth and justice to reign undisturbed.
Yeah, that's pretty upfront, isn't it? I mean, that statement alone really sets the stage. It helps explain why, for instance, the Oriental Orthodox churches ultimately rejected the council's decisions. They saw these procedural issues right from the start.
Okay, so given that rather dramatic admission about, truth and justice being disturbed, where do we start? What are the first sort of procedural red flags that pop up in the sources?
Well, the first and maybe the most glaring one is about who set the agenda. It wasn't just the bishops hashing things out.
Okay.
Our sources show it was heavily influenced, maybe even directed, by secular officials, people representing the emperor, and also by the patriarchal staff back in the capital.
So we're not just talking about some background influence. This sounds more like direct political engineering of what was even up for discussion.
That's exactly what the sources suggest. It means the theological framework itself might have been shaped by political goals right from the get-go, which, kind of compromises the whole idea of spiritual independence.
Yeah, that's a big one right out of the gate. Beyond the agenda setting, were there issues with how things were recorded, the information itself?
Oh, absolutely. The integrity of the official record, the acts, is definitely questionable according to these analyses.
How so?
Well, the compilers, the people putting the acts together, seem to have made a, quote, deliberate and explicit decision to suppress the text of the first draft definition from a key session, session V.
Suppress a draft. Wow.
And that's not all. Sources also indicate that in some early sessions, additional debate took place but was not recorded, deliberately not recorded.
So missing information isn't just accidental gaps. It's potentially deliberate suppression and omission, leaving us with a skewed picture.
Precisely. It leaves you wondering what crucial arguments or disagreements were just, well, erased from the official story.
That idea of unrecorded debates and hidden drafts is it's pretty staggering. Were there other problems with just the basic cataloging or presentation of what did get recorded?
Yes, even the basics are messy. The actual naming and numbering of the council sessions, it's inconsistent across different editions of the Acts.
Oh, that makes things difficult.
It does. It makes tracing the exact flow of discussion and decisions really tricky. And then there's this other striking thing, canons 1 through 27.
Official rules or decrees, right?
Exactly. They were somehow excluded from the numbered sequence of sessions in the Acts, and there's no clear record, no evidence of them actually being discussed or formally approved during any recorded session.
Wait, so how did they become official council canons if there's no record of their approval?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? It's like laws appearing on the hooks without any legislative history. It really undermines the perceived legitimacy of those canons, at least based on the surviving documentation.
It feels like trying to piece together a puzzle with half the pieces missing, and maybe some pieces that don't even belong. What about how the mood or the consensus of the council was captured?
Yeah, that's another point our sources highlight, building on this theme of, let's say, manipulated records. Acclamations, those shouts of approval or agreement. They were often written down as coming from the Holy Council, implying everyone agreed. But the analysis suggests sometimes it was just a particularly loud faction, maybe strategically placed, making all the noise.
Ah, so presenting a vocal minority as the unanimous voice of the entire council.
Exactly. It shows how easily the narrative could be shaped, how selective reporting of even things like applause or shouts could create a false sense of unity.
These details, they really do offer a completely different way to look at Chalcedon. It shifts the focus from just what they decided theologically to how those decisions were made and maybe who was pulling the strings.
Absolutely. And if we pull back and look at the bigger picture, what really stands out is how much the process itself mattered. The recording, the suppressing, the presenting of information, it clearly influenced the outcomes and fed into these major historical divisions in Christianity that persist even today.
Right. It drives home that understanding history isn't just about the final headlines, but about the messy, often political, process of how things were allowed to happen and who got to control that narrative.
It really does. And maybe this raises a question for you listening to this. When you look at any historical account, how can we even begin to discern those unrecorded debates or spot the suppressed drafts? How do we listen for the silences?
That's a powerful thought to end on. Sometimes the silences, the gaps in the record, they might actually speak louder than the words that were written down. Gives you a lot to think about.